Welcome to Background Briefing. This is Howard Bloom sitting in for Ian Masters. The November wildfire in Paradise, California killed at least 85 people. The same month, the Woolsey Fire in Southern California killed three and destroyed 1,500 structures in Malibu and nearby areas. What have we learned? With us today, we have two journalists who have covered the fires from different perspectives and the director of a land trust who had to confront the dangers in the aftermath of the Malibu fires firsthand. Two of our guests are in studio, but we're going to begin this discussion with LA Times reporter Bettina Boxall. She is a past Pulitzer Prize winner who joins us by phone. To set the table for this discussion, can you remind us about the extent of the devastation caused by these latest fires?
Well, the campfire in Paradise in Northern California was by any measure the worst recorded fire disaster in California history, both in terms of the number of deaths and in terms of the number of structures that were destroyed.
You're an environmental reporter for the LA Times. You've been doing this a long time. As a journalist covering these issues, how has the story on the ground evolved? How has it seemed to change from your perspective?
The fire situation has gotten worse for a number of reasons that vary somewhat according to where you are in the state. But fires are bigger and they're more destructive and they are harder to basically contain than they have been in the past. And as I said, there are a number of different reasons for that, and it really depends on what part of the state you're in.
Let's talk about some of the whys here, because people want to know if the fires are bigger, faster, more destructive, and more often. In fact, we used to have a fire season. Do we even have a fire season, or is it?
Yes, we do. I mean, you know, there's sort of a cliche now that we have, you know, the fire is year-round, but that's not exactly true. But the fire season is longer than it used to be, and it officially has sort of started around, you know, May or June, and then, you know, depending on the part of the state, you go toward the end of the year. So let's start with in the Sierra Nevada, which is, of course, our biggest mountainous region and is forested. There was a history of fire suppression. In other words, the federal land agencies, the Forest Service, et cetera, that managed these lands starting, you know, in the early 1900s, had a policy of putting out fires, wildfires, as quickly as they could. And so that altered the natural fire cycle in some parts of the Sierra Nevada. And again, this is not one size fits all, but some elevations of the Sierra Nevada were naturally used to frequent what they call low-intensity fires. So they would come through every so often, and they would burn, you know, the undergrowth, and they would burn the smaller trees, and they would maintain a more open setting. And this is particularly true in what they call the Ponderosa Pine Belt. So fire suppression policies basically ended those frequent nature's housekeeping fires. And then you had very intensive logging on federal forests and national forests in the Sierra in much of the 20th century. And they took out, I mean, what is commercially valuable are big old trees, and the big old trees are actually the most fire resistant. So they took out the most fire resistant trees, and they left the smaller trees, and they often did clear cuts, and they planted plantations, you know, planting, you know, trees for future harvest. And those plantations often were not thinned, and so you wound up with a very dense, uniform, young growth, the kind of growth that a fire just loves to chew through. So that's, you know, that's one element in the Sierra Nevada. Then in Southern California, I mean, you know, we have a different ecosystem. It's, you know, I mean, what's been burning in all of these big fires this year, they have not been forest fires. They've been burning chaparral, they've been burning oak woodlands, they've been burning grasslands, and even the campfire in Paradise, it's in a forested area, but it burned through an area that had been burned just a decade before and logged. So these fires have not been burning heavy timber. And in Southern California, they are chaparral fires. And we've always had, you know, some big chaparral fires, but we've had many more of them because most wildfires in California, particularly in Southern California, are human-related. A downed power line in a wind, someone using equipment when it's hot and dry and windy, a spark from a car, etc. And so we have, obviously, a huge population in Southern California, and we have more roads and wildlands, and we have more development on the edge of wildlands, on the edge of basically flammable landscapes. And so this has greatly increased the number of ignitions during high wind events. all of California is subject to seasonal high winds coming from the interior. In Southern California, we call them the Santa Anas. They peak in the fall and the early winter. So whereas 150 years ago, you might have a big Santa Ana wind event, there wouldn't have been an ignition. So even though it was hot and it was dry and it was windy and you had this flammable landscape, there was no ignition because we don't get much lightning in Southern California. Now we have all these ignitions, and climate change is one factor. It is just one factor. I mean, it's accentuating the drought. It's not the cause of drought. Most people would not say it's causing these severe droughts we've had, but it exacerbates their impact. So the soil gets dried out. The vegetation gets dried out. You have more mortality. I mean, we had a very severe statewide drought for about 5 years recently, and that resulted in a lot of dieback of shrubs, the chaparral in Southern California. So there you have dead fuel and, you know, the warmer temperatures. Basically, you know, again, they accentuate and make more severe fire conditions. It's not a one-size-fits-all. It's complex. There are a number of factors going on, but those are some of them.
That was Bettina Boxall. She's a reporter for the LA Times. And now I'd like to bring in our second guest. That is Carrie Cavanaugh. She writes editorials for the LA Times related to the wildfires. Carrie Cavanaugh, as you hear the description of the devastation and the factors contributing to it, what is going through your head?
I think what we're seeing is that a lot of the past practices and past decisions are coming to bear now, and the exacerbating influences of climate change are sort of creating past and the present and the future are creating these much more intense, devastating wildfires. And it's a real challenge for policymakers and the public because you've got to rectify some of the decisions of the past, particularly in terms of forest management and catching up on that area. But then also you have to sort of look forward and figure out the policies for the future in this changing environment. And it's really challenging. And so far, I'm an opinion writer, so the opinion that we've had is that policymakers have really not fully grappled with the past, the present, and the future, and we are really seeing the influence that come to bear now.
Well, let's unpack that a little bit. It looks like some of this is that we're not doing enough planning ahead, and that some of this is that the planning that we thought would work isn't working. So can we parse that out a little bit, what falls into each of those categories in terms of the recent fires?
Yeah, I mean, in terms of the planning that we didn't do, I mean, you could very much see that in the Sierras and the sort of landscape and the thinning and the forest management that needs to happen in the Sierras. And also you see that when towns like Paradise and some of these Sierra towns that were built without adequate evacuation routes, without thorough, you know, sort of modern evacuation sort of alert systems, you see communities and land that wasn't managed properly or not designed properly for a threat that is growing now. Policymakers have to go back and rectify that. And looking forward, I mean, there's ample scientific research that shows that the factors of climate change are going to make these fires worse. So now decision makers are in the position of having to say, well, knowing what we believe is going to happen on the horizon, how do we plan for future communities? Because inevitably, California has to grow. I mean, we have a growing population. We have tremendous demand for housing, for jobs, for services. So we are going to be a growing state. So how do we grow with the recognition that climate change is going to exacerbate these wildfires?
Well, let's go back to some of the measures, the planning measures. I mean, it's not as though nobody was expecting these fires and also that nobody was doing anything. I mean, I don't think there's a house built in California that doesn't have a fireproof roof on it at this point. And most houses have, at least the new construction in particular, has surfaces that do not combust easily. They have screens over the vents to prevent embers from flying in there. And yet, you had houses that had many of these safety features that burned to the ground. I mean, hundreds of houses. And in many cases in Paradise, the houses were more combustible than the trees around them. You had trees that are still standing and surviving next to houses of which nothing remains but a chimney. I guess, Bettina, we'll go back to you and then Carrie.
A couple of things. What we've seen out of Paradise is very typical, and we've seen this over and over and over again in big wind-driven wildfires. Basically, buildings and houses are fuel, you know, in a wildfire. I mean, there's this idea that this horrific, you know, wave wave of flames comes through and just chews everything up and wipes everything clean. That's not what happens. What happens is the wind carries embers and firebrands, and they get lodged in different parts of buildings. Often the building really burns from the inside. And in the meantime, I looked at some photographs in Paradise, and it's particularly striking. I mean, not only are, you know, the pine trees near the buildings largely unburned, but you'll even see green grass and shrubs, you know, right there. They didn't burn. I think what people forget is that houses are fuel from a fire's perspective. And the other thing is that, yes, there are these fire-resistant code restrictions now, but there have been millions and millions and millions of homes in Southern California, well, in California in general, all over the state, that were built before those codes were put in place. So they don't have ember-proof vents, or they don't have up-to-code roofs. I mean, that's a problem that has been well-known for years. And, I mean, I think there is some discussion of, hey, maybe instead of using all this FEMA money to clean up after disaster, maybe we ought to be giving, you know, more grants and more loans, low-interest loans, so that existing homes that aren't built in a fire-resistant way can be upgraded. And then, as you pointed out, Howard, there are brand-new homes, or you know, pretty new homes that have all these bells and whistles that they're supposed to have, that, you know, that are supposed to prevent them from going up in flames, and they still burn because inevitably there's some, you know, little crack someplace, or a doggy door, or, you know, God knows where some embers can get in and smolder and start a fire. When the wind is blowing 50 miles an hour and you've got this blizzard of embers, I mean, it's really unbelievable conditions. And so we still have this conventional wisdom that, oh, if we just build in a certain way, we can handle the problem. Well, you know what? It's not really working. We have to get to the point, I think, where we recognize, you know what? There are just certain places, certain known wind corridors. I mean, Malibu is one of them. Malibu has mapped wind corridors. It's burned over and over and over again. We have to be, I think, much more far-sighted in saying, no, there are certain places where we cannot develop. It's just too unsafe. I mean, this has become, as one of the sources in one of my stories said, it's becoming a matter of life and death. We can't just keep on going down the same road where we pretend, oh, if we just do this, we can build wherever we want and we can do whatever we want. Well, you know what? We can't. The winds are not going to stop. And unless we pave over the entire state, which hopefully we're not going to do, there's always going to be some vegetation to burn.
Carrie Cavanaugh wanted to jump in here.
Yeah, what's interesting too, and everything that Bettina said is right on. I mean, there's also these fire-resistant construction standards have typically only been required in areas that are sort of mapped as high fire risk. But we're also seeing that fires are not necessarily following the maps. I mean, Santa Rosa, that burned through suburban communities that nobody thought was necessarily in a high fire risk area. So the fires are not conforming to our plans and our best efforts to be resistant to them.
Right. How dare those fires not conform to our plans? Well, let's bring in our third guest, Ezekiel Chalais. He is the executive director of the Mountains Restoration Trust, which is dedicated to preserving the natural and cultural resources of the Santa Monica Mountains through habitat restoration, education, land acquisition, and conservation easements. And as I understand it, the fire burned through holdings of the trust, and you also were a fire evacuee, correct?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, and sadly, this is in recent memory. This isn't Mountains Restoration Trust's first bout with fire. In 2016, somebody ran into a power pole off Mulholland Drive in Calabasas, causing a 500-acre burn, which in that 500 acres was MRT's headquarters, which we're still rebuilding. And in the recent Woolsey fire, our largest land holding, the Cold Creek Preserve, was spared, but a 150-acre La Sierra Preserve, which is adjacent to the Seminole Springs Mobile Home Park, which lost about 80 homes, that entire preserve burned down, and it's now become that all-too-familiar charred moonscape that you see throughout the Santa Monica Mountains after this fire. And our most unfortunate loss was our native plant operations, which was on state parks. This was a nursery that was producing over 3,000 native plants that we use in our restoration efforts. So that's kind of our biggest loss and our biggest focus in rebuilding after the fire.
Okay. And those are significant losses. A little bit of a happier spoiler alert. Your own apartment unit in Malibu did not burn down. But remind us for a moment about the terror of that night.
Yeah, so me and my partner actually live on the edge of Malibu, which is an unincorporated area of Los Angeles right next to the Giddy Villa off of PCH. But on Friday evening, I was driving through the canyon from Calabasas back to home. And, you know, I saw the smoke in the valley as I headed home over Topanga Canyon and didn't think too much of it other than I knew that winds were picking up and I knew that it was going to be a bad fire. But by morning, we read the news that the fire had jumped the 101 freeway. And the forecasts for the Santa Ana winds were very high over the weekend. And, you know, after reading that, I told my partner, Julie, and I said, pack your bags up for the week, take pictures of the entire apartment, and I'm not going to be surprised if we don't have a home to come back to in a few days. Previous to this fire and reading and doing presentations about wildfires, that fire wants to burn from the valley all the way to the coast. That's what the fire wants to do. And when you have Santa Ana winds that don't stop, that's what the fire is going to do. And as you can see, that happened through Malibu. Luckily for us, the winds died down on Saturday and they were able to kind of stop the fire from pushing too far past Las Verdes Malibu Canyon, which kind of spared our Cold Creek Preserve. It spared Topanga Canyon and therefore our neighborhood was spared the fire. But I truly believe that was only because the winds died down on Saturday and gave the firefighters a break to kind of put some fire lines in place.
Now, there's an interesting contrast you talked about. You said that in one area that has, includes land that your reserve manages, there was a mobile home park. Can you compare the impact to the reserve versus the impact to the mobile home park?
Yeah, and something I keep going back to over and over after this fire is the saddest part about all these fires are the communities. There are some devastations to regrowing and restoring our preserves, but they are minuscule compared to people that lost their homes. 80 of the homes in the Seminole Springs Mobile Home Park burned down. The devastation doesn't stop there. This last weekend, Senator Henry Stern's office and MRT did a sandbagging event because they have a lake right next to their property that is filled with sediment already. It needs to be dredged. And with coming storms and possible floodings, there's going to be more homes in Seminole Homes Mobile Home Park that can be flooded. And so the danger is not over there. And again, the communities that lost homes and are in danger of flooding, that's the real devastation of this fire. There are some hurdles in restoring our lands, but we can overcome them. And they're just not as devastating as the people who lost their homes.
We're going to focus more on these homes later in the show. But just for a moment, let's indulge here. I mean, what is the impact on the flora and fauna when a fire sweeps through an area like this?
The flora and fauna is resilient, but it's a complicated, the land will be fine. Land that has not burned in the last 15 years will probably do just fine. And in fact, some species like manzanita depend on fire for their seeds to germinate. And many of the plants in the Santa Monica Mountains are well adapted to fire. However, they are not well adapted to fires happening as often as they are happening. So when you have fires that come through twice in 20 years, that is depleting the seed bank, that is depleting the reserves for these plants to resprout, and it's becoming more difficult for these habitats to rebound. And so couple that with the extra pressures that development and humans are putting on the land, it is becoming more and more difficult for these mountainsides to rebound. And when you have some of these fires that come through more often than 15, 20 years at a time, and these seed banks can't quickly reserve, what happens if you have these invasive grasses that come in and turn something that was once a chaparral habitat, they turn into grasslands. And when these grasslands come in, you have longer fire seasons. These grasslands are more fire prone. They will ignite more quickly. And then in addition, they don't offer as much flooding control to the human and animal populations that are in the area. Kind of what we're dealing with is a lot of the land will be fine. It needs our help. We have to replant. We need our nursery back up and running. And we need to ensure that our natural, beautiful landscape of chaparral and sage scrub habitat does not turn into grasslands, which would be bad not only for the ecosystem, it'd be bad for humans as well.
And a lot of those grasslands, those grasses are actually non-native species. They're invasive species that are not perfectly suited to this habitat.
Correct. We do have some wonderful native grasses, but a lot of the ones that are causing problems and establish themselves after a fire are the invasive species.
And how about the animals? I know some people listening to this are concerned about how the animals get through a fire season.
And again, it's a complicated answer because if humans weren't as populous as they are in the Santa Monica Mountains, the animals would be just fine. There would be plenty of places for them to roam and take up new habitats. But when you have animals such as the mountain lions, which many of them survived, I believe there was 13 that were being tracked and 12 of them survived and one of them didn't, they can move. But when their habitats are constricted and many of their habitats have been degraded, it becomes much more difficult when you have a fire that comes through like the Woolsey Fire.
I want to note that the Mountains Restoration Trust is having some upcoming events if you are local to this area. In fact, in a couple of hours at 6 p.m. tonight, Thursday, in the Agoura Hills Calabasas Community Center, experts will walk you through the fascinating complexities of fire ecology, which Ezekiel has just run through a little bit himself. And for more information, go to the events page on the website of the Mountains Restoration Trust. So if you do an internet search for Mountains Restoration Trust and look up events, you'll find some interesting ones there, including one in just a couple of hours. You are tuned in to Background Briefing with Howard Bloom, sitting in for Ian Masters on KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles and the Pacifica Network. We've been talking about the wildfires this time and next time.
Well, you've got your diamonds and you've got your pretty clothes and the chauffeur drives your cars. You let everybody know. But don't play with me, 'cause you're playing with fire. Your mother, she's a...
Welcome back to Background Briefing. This is Howard Bloom, sitting in for Ian Masters on KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles and the Pacifica Network. We've been talking about the wildfires this time and next time. My guests are LA Times reporter Bettina Boxall, LA Times editorial writer Carrie Cavanaugh, and Ezekiel Chalais, who is the executive director of the Mountains Restoration Trust. Carrie Cavanaugh, you were going to build on those comments.
Actually, I had a question. You know, there's so much talk about forest management and land management, and we think about the Sierras. But what about in the chaparral areas, like in Southern California? Is there more we need to be doing to manage the land to reduce the sort of propensity of wildfires and the intensity?
Yeah, so that's a really complicated question and a good question. What's interesting that's happening right now is I actually am hearing from a decent portion of the Malibu community that, you know, they are angry at the chaparral habitat and the so-called fuel buildup that's happening there. But the fact of the matter is these fires are wind and humidity driven. The cost of clearing out any brush or fuel load, that's an important thing to do around homes, and it's an important activity to do around any structures. But the idea that we're going to go out in the chaparral and clear out this densely wooded area, that's kind of its natural state, that's not going to really change how big these fires are and how destructive these fires are. And it would be more costly than it's worth doing. Now, that said, a lot of the local coastal planning does not allow for any brush clearance that's beyond 200 feet from any homes. And I would like some more exploration of people that are environmentally sensitive, organizations like MRT that are more environmentally sensitive. Are there some actions that can be taken around homes that can kind of mitigate some of these embers from coming closer to homes?
Bettina Boxall.
If I can jump in there, I mean, you know, I very much agree with what Ezekiel has been saying. And, you know, again, you know, the most destructive fires and, you know, the Woolsey, the Camp, et cetera, they're always wind-driven. And in these wind-driven events, 100 feet of brush clearance or 200 feet of brush clearance doesn't make any difference. Over and over and over again, we've seen the embers and spot fires jump 8 lane freeways. They jump rivers. They jump fuel breaks. So these preventative measures don't work in these really high-intensity fires and strong wind fires. And if you go out and clear the brush or burn it, you know, grind it up, what is it replaced by? It's replaced by invasive grasses. And invasive grasses ignite more easily. They burn very quickly. And if you look back, you know, across the U.S., the biggest fires in the lower 48 are grass fires. Just 2 years ago, I think, in the Plains fires in Texas and the plains of the central U.S., they burned millions of acres. So the idea that, oh, we just need to go out there and clear the brush and grind it up and get rid of it and everything will be fine is nonsensical. I mean, it's all you do when you replace chaparral with grasses. That's what happens. Invasive grasses is all you do is you accelerate the fire cycle and you make it more likely that you will have fire every year. And you're also destroying a biologically rich, important native ecosystem and replacing it with grasslands that are biologically and from an ecological standpoint are really pretty worthless.
Ezekiel, you wanted to jump in here.
Yeah, and I wanted to add on to that narrative that the services that this native chaparral, this densely wooded area offers to us humans outside of a wildfire is often overlooked. What happens in these large rain events, which we're going to have more of because of climate change, these weather patterns are going to get more intense, is rain is going to come harder and more often in these places that we live. And what these chaparral do is they act as this wonderful umbrella on the hillside that if all of this chaparral was cleared, you would have a lot more erosion and you would have a lot more flooding and more often. And so this chaparral is not necessarily the enemy. The Santa Ana winds are, the low humidity is, but the chaparral isn't necessarily your enemy here. Unless someone can geoengineer the stopping of the Santa Ana winds, these fires are going to continue to happen.
You are tuned in to Background Briefing on KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara, and other stations in the Pacifica Network. I'm Howard Bloom, sitting in for Ian Masters as the guest host today while Ian is on a well-deserved vacation. And we are talking about the fires this time and the fires next time, the wildfires in Los Angeles. And we have a great panel today to do that. We have LA Times veteran environmental reporter Bettina Boxall. She is joining us over the phone. And in studio, we have Carrie Cavanaugh, who writes editorials about wildfires for the LA Times. And we have Ezekiel Chalace. He is the executive director of the Mountains Restoration Trust, which is dedicated to preserving the natural and cultural resources of the Santa Monica Mountains. By the way, they have an event tonight at 6 p.m. in the Agoura Hills Calabasas Community Center to walk people through the ecology, the complex ecology of fires. For more information, you can go to the events page on the website of the Mountains Restoration Trust. I want to pitch this conversation forward a bit. The two recent big fires that we've been talking about mostly are out, and due to recent rains, it looks as though we may get a few months off from the fires, although we now have to worry about potentially deadly mudslides on hills swept bare of vegetation. Ezekiel has moved back into his Malibu apartment unit, so we're happy about that. He's probably happy about that, but should we have let him do that? Should we have said, no, Ezekiel, you cannot go back here. Bad boy, you have to live somewhere else. Should he have been allowed to return home to Malibu ever? And I guess before I let people answer, I'll set this up with one more thing here. An early important writing on this topic was by urban historian Mike Davis. Davis points out that fires are part of local ecology, especially in Malibu. He argues that it is a waste of public resources to spend millions saving homes in areas never meant for subdivisions and mansions. As writer Gustavo Arellano has pointed out in the LA Times, we build deeper into canyons and foothills, daring Mother Nature to give us her best shot, and then we are shocked when she does. Okay, who wants to take that challenge first? Bettina,
well,
the first
I'm not
shot
going
at this.
To suggest that Ezekiel shouldn't move back into his home, but I am going to suggest that the county and the state take a much stronger role in where developments can be sited and where construction can be sited in these high fire zones and these high wind zones. And again, we know where they are. They're mapped. We have increasingly good, you know, records of the wind events and technology. And, you know, and yet we continue to let homes be built on ridge lines in windy areas. I mean, you know, that's just like candy for a fire. You've got this big house on a ridge line in a fire zone. I mean, we've quoted in the LA Times articles about the Woolsey Fire, we've quoted a number of homeowners whose homes burned, you know, in previous Malibu fires, which they happen over and over and over again. And they're, you know, saying, oh, we're going to rebuild. And one of the sources that I spoke to for one of my recent stories said, you know what, if people want to do that, we should say, okay, fine, we'll pay for your, you know, insurance and give you a FEMA grant when your house burns once. Burns a second time, we're not going to help you. You are on your own. You have to eat the entire losses. That can sound harsh, but why should the federal taxpayer, through FEMA grants and through government insurance that you know, homeowners in certain, you know, high fire area zones, they cannot get private insurance, but their fallback, there's a fallback state insurance program. Why should taxpayers be subsidizing the reconstruction of homes on lots that have burned before so that they can burn again? I mean, I think that is a very legitimate question.
So, Carrie Kavanaugh?
I think Bettina raises excellent points. I mean, there's a precedent for some of these decisions. There's programs that when the Mississippi River has flooded, FEMA will come in and buy up properties that have flooded previously. It's voluntary, as opposed to letting people rebuild or encouraging them to rebuild again and again and again. There's planned retreat programs that are being developed that buy out people who are living in coastal areas that are going to be inundated by sea level rise. So there's a precedent for government intervening. Typically, it is voluntary. We in this country have a strong sense of property rights, and as a government and a public are very hesitant on prohibiting people from doing with their land what they wish. And so there's really going to be a discussion about when does government need to step in and prevent people from exercising their private property rights and the threat to public safety.
Now let's bring in Ezekiel since we were talking about where he lives, right?
Yeah, on this first topic that Bettina and Carrie have talked about, I just want to say that, you know, humans have lived along the coast of California and in Malibu. The Chumash Indians, you know, they have records dating back over 15,000 years. So this idea that we're going to extirpate humans from this culturally significant place and a place which their families and they have history here is, I think, quite a wild idea. Now, that said, I think we do need to be cognizant about climate change and the certain events that are going to be happening in areas over and over. But when the, you know, the devastating Anchorage, Alaska earthquake happened, we didn't say we're not going to rebuild Anchorage. What we said is we're going to rebuild Anchorage to be earthquake proof, or at least mitigate any of the damages that could be caused by an earthquake. What I keep seeing is people making wildfire the enemy, rather than thinking the wildfires are happening and how can we rebuild and build wisely to mitigate the damages. The building codes are still not up to par to properly ensure safety of people and homes when these fires happen. County of Los Angeles Fire Department and Cal Fire Safe Councils have done a wonderful job of recommending things you can do to make your homes fire wise. And one clear example of this is in the current building code, these meshes that you put in your chimneys or any openings in your home, the current standard is only for a fourth of an inch, which is not effective to stopping these embers. There's some simple things, and there's an adoption and learning curve that many homes that are rebuilding or current homes, you know, they definitely need to take responsibility and step up. And I know many people may have inherited a home from their parents that is built out of wood, and they don't have all the money in the world to completely rebuild their home. And that's understandable, and I don't expect them to move. But to become more educated on what you can do, I don't think it's an excuse to say, I don't have the money to do it. I think everyone needs to take responsibility, learn as much as possible about how wildfires burn, and then learn of all the steps they can take to make themselves safer as well as their homes.
Can we think our way out of this? Bettina, what would you say?
In terms of, oh, you know, we didn't tell Anchorage that they could rebuild. We know exactly where these winds blow. They have been mapped in Malibu. okay? An earthquake, you cannot predict exactly where it is going to happen. It's not like you can say, okay, we know that every 20 years there's going to be an earthquake at this point in Anchorage, Alaska. We know exactly where these winds blow and where they have blown. And you can go back into the fire history of Malibu, and you can see that every 20 years or so, it burns all the way from the valley to the beach. I mean, I found this fascinating CAL FIRE report that was written after the 1993 fire, which I was up for 36 hours straight covering that, out all night, you know, watching the canyons just glow orange and, you know, as the fire just burned down the orange toward the beach. I take exception that there are certain areas that we know are just incredibly fire prone. And the idea that we can keep putting houses there and that it's all going to be fine if we just build them the right way, I disagree with. I think we're putting people we're endangering their lives. We're eating up millions, if not billions, of taxpayer money. Ultimately, more people on the landscape means more ignitions, and it's more likely to be destroying the native ecosystems and a parkland that we are supposed to be protecting.
You are tuned into Background Briefing with Howard Bloom, sitting in for Ian Masters on KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles and the Pacifica Network. We've been talking about the wildfires this time and next time. Welcome back to Background Briefing. This is Howard Bloom. We've been talking about the wildfires this time and next time. My guests are LA Times reporter Bettina Boxall, LA Times editorial writer Kerry Cavanaugh, and Ezekiel Chalais, who is the executive director of the Mountains Restoration Trust. Ezekiel, what is the zeitgeist in Malibu? Are people resilient in the sense that, oh, you know, this isn't going to beat us, we are going to rebuild? Or are they saying, why didn't the fire department protect us? What are you hearing down there?
Yeah, so what's interesting is we have our event tonight in Calabasas, Agora Hills, but the following Thursday, we have another town hall in Malibu. And what's interesting is some of my Malibu close friends are saying, you cannot have this discussion right now. People are not ready to hear it. They're mad at the forest. They're mad at the fire department. They're mad at the policies that have been put into place. And you talking about fires being a natural occurrence or talking about ways you could have defended your home is going to irritate a lot of the public and the community that are there. That said, what is so fascinating during this post-fire recovery times is these communities are so strong. They've gone into kind of a battle mode of like, I have been offended and I have been attacked, which they have been by a wildfire. They are showing some strong resilience of, we are Malibu, we are a strong community, and we will rebuild and we will rebuild stronger. And I also want to say, Bettina, I don't disagree with you. I definitely think that we need to create a much, much smarter development. And we shouldn't be permitting in areas where we know fires are going to blaze through more often and more frequently as time goes forward. So I'm in wholehearted agreement with you there. I just don't want to tell people they can't rebuild their homes where they have already been built. And I strongly believe that communities have not done everything they can. And I'm going to get in trouble by the community for saying this, but if you live in a neighborhood where five of the houses have done everything to be fire-wise and you have two houses that have not and their gutters are filled with leaves, that entire community is now in danger of going up in flames because you have two community members that didn't do everything that they could have. In Australia, you know, communities really do take ownership of defending their property. It's not the government did something wrong or the fire department did something wrong. It's, as a community, I am going to do everything I can to fight this fire myself.
as we're having this discussion, there are still more proposals to build into new areas that are prone to fire, notably Tejon Ranch in the northern part of LA County, north of Los Angeles. The previous issues there related to environmental degradation and water shortages, so that development always had some controversy attached to it. But now we have the additional element of fire. From 1964 to 2015, Cal Fire recorded 31 wildfires larger than 100 acres within 5 miles of Centennial, which is the name of the proposed development, including 4 within the project's boundaries. Now, that's according to county planning documents. So how do we feel about this proposed Tejon Ranch development in light of other things that we're discussing? Carrie Cavanaugh, you want to take that one?
It's a really bad idea. I understand. Listen, we write a lot about the need for housing in California and the lack of housing, lack of affordable housing. So I understand that. But the idea of putting essentially a new city in the middle of a higher fire zone, in the middle of a completely otherwise open space area, is just crazy on multiple levels. Because as we've just talked about, when you do that, you not only put more people at risk of wildfire, you dramatically increase the risk of creating a wildfire. You're stringing power lines through there. You're having more vehicles on the roads there. You are putting more ignition sources in that community. So you're exponentially increasing the risk to the people that you put there. The developers say, we're going to put in lots of fire stations and we're going to have really great fire service. And it's, you are putting people into a dangerous situation and then trying to put in things to support them in that dangerous situation. They shouldn't even be there in the first place.
And are they listening to the LA Times opinions on this one?
Well, we haven't written our opinion piece yet, but I guess you can see where we're going. But no, as of now, it looks like LA County is going to approve this project. The Planning Commission supported it. The Board of Supervisors is going to vote on it next Tuesday. And there's even some suggestion, and I haven't actually done the research yet on this, that the county's hands are somewhat tied. In rejecting the project. If a developer goes through, you know, XYZ hoops and they do an environmental impact report saying that they can make the community safe, it becomes harder for the county to reject the project. And that, again, is on paper. You can say, we're going to put in lots of fire stations, we're going to put in fire-resistant roofs, and you can do everything on paper, but we are seeing again and again that those practices on paper do not play out in real life.
The role of the government in telling people where they can and cannot live. But Tina, what are your sources telling you about the role of the government here?
Well, I mean, one person that I spoke to suggested that the state create basically the equivalent of a wildfire commission similar to our coastal commission. I mean, the state does have input in development. I mean, all you have to do is look at our world-famous Coastal Act. And, I mean, there certainly are issues of private property. Last year when I was writing a story, I spoke to L.A. County planning officials, and I said, has LA County ever denied a development application because of its location in a very high fire hazard zone or, you know, a wind zone? And the reply was, no, we have to respect private property rights. But, I mean, I think we can certainly take a greater role both at the county level and at the state level in siting and how developments are laid out and developed. And I also go back, you know, to this notion that, oh, planning is local and it's jealously guarded and, you know, the state, well, you know, the state legislature had no qualms, I forget when it was, about 20 years ago, about passing a state law that barred local cities and towns from adopting new rent control laws. So they had no problem interfering there. So I think, you know, the notion that it's completely hands-off, I think, needs to be challenged because, as I said earlier, I mean, it's becoming a matter of life and death and the expenditure of enormous sums of public money.
I want to go back to Ezekiel for a moment because he's been looking at how communities can defend themselves and take responsibility. Ezekiel is the executive director of a local land trust here.
Often it comes down to, I don't have the money to put in double pane windows. I don't have the money to switch my siding of my house to wood to stucco. And again, it takes one or two weak links in your neighborhood to make your entire neighborhood statistically more likely to burn down. So I kind of wanted to go back and just say knowledge is power. If we can understand how wildfires work, if we can understand how we can statistically reduce the risk of our homes burning down, our communities burning down. Now, I don't think that, to Bettina's point, I don't think that excuses building in a high fire prone area, we have to be very intelligent about the way we build our communities, as well as the existing communities, what we can do to make them safer. You know, there's simple things like if a neighborhood has 10 pools in it and everyone put up a placard in front of their home that says, I've got a pool in my backyard. And oh, by the way, I've also put fire hoses in my pool when a fire is coming, and the hose can wrap around the entire house. And the fire department knows that. Guess what? Your home is now statistically going to survive, and a firefighter is going to go in there and use your pool and use that water. Because when you have these huge fires rolling through, the water pressure and the water systems that these fire hydrants, they get a lot lower and they're a lot less effective. So there's some intelligence that can be put in for the communities that are already in place. And then there's a lot of intelligence that needs to go in of, yes, do we develop here? Do we not develop here because of the risks that are at play?
The water pressure raises an interesting issue, because it's not as though that you go in as a firefighter and everything is there for you. You know, you have electricity, you have internet service, you have water, and you can use all that to fight one of these fires. And along those lines, we also have something that is called an emergency alert system. And that was one of the bigger failures here. Carrie, go ahead.
And I'm leaning heavily on the reporting of Times staffers that in so many of these communities, the counties are relying on private services to collect landlines and collect voluntary opt-in phone numbers for people to be called in an emergency, as opposed to using, you know, the cell phone, the automatic Amber Alert-like cell phone alert system that's been developed at the federal level. And so, I mean, in Paradise, I think some of the reporting showed that a minuscule portion of people who signed up for an alert to evacuate their home, and second, that even a more small number of people actually got the alert. So when there is an emergency, again, everything that we've talked about has been about, if you are going to live in these high fire risk areas, you have to, you know, build a certain way, you have to develop policies to work with the fire service. And the other part is to have adequate evacuation alerts so that people can save their lives by getting out of the path of fire. And even that most basic function is not working.
Bettina, did you want to add anything to that?
Well, yeah, I mean, I actually sit next to the reporter who's been doing a lot of that work. And I mean, clearly the alert system and the evacuation plans in Paradise felt, you know, dramatically short. And these systems, you know, are largely voluntary. Most people in the communities, you know, most people in Paradise had not signed up for them. And then they don't, you know, necessarily even work for those who have signed up for them. So I think there is this federal Amber Alert system out there that I think is much more reliable and much more likely, you know, to reach everybody. I mean, there are always going to still be some technology issues, you know, when the power goes out and, you know, you lose cell surface. But I think clearly far more can be done in terms of getting out widespread alerts on time. I mean, in both Paradise and in the Wine Country fires, a tangential problem was that so many of the residents, you know, or a large portion of the residents were elderly and some of them were disabled. So, I mean, you know, that is another problem, that even if they, you know, they get an alert, it's not like they can just like sprint into their cars and leave, because, you know, some of them, you know, are in wheelchairs and are, you know, basically physically disabled.
Oh, Ezekiel, you wanted to add something here?
Yeah, I wanted to add kind of a personal experience in living in some of these areas and having, you know, our office and other spaces that were right in the fire's path. First, I think the firefighters did an absolutely amazing job fighting the fires. Driving through the canyons and looking at what homes did survive is shocking when you look around where the fire's path was and how some of these homes did survive. But where was lacking for me was this kind of communication system. As mentioned at the beginning of this segment, is I live in an unincorporated area of Los Angeles on the edge of Malibu, and the information was zilch. There was no information about my particular neighborhood of, are we supposed to evacuate? Are we not supposed to evacuate? The only thing I knew is that police had stopped cars from moving in at Sunset and PCH, but there was no designation to my particular neighborhood. And I remember, you know, in the Friday, Saturday, Sunday of the fire, most of my good information came from watching news helicopters and seeing where the fire was going. I often had the question of, well, what are the firefighters using to fight? What maps are they using to fight the fires? And I'm not saying they did a bad job. Again, I think they did a wonderful job fighting the fires. I think there is a lack of communication of how they're fighting the fires, why people are being evacuated or not being evacuated. A couple of our board members at MRT live in the Montanito community. And what was happening the week after the fire was no cars were allowed into the neighborhood. And that's because CHP could not stop you from walking into your neighborhood, but they could stop you from driving into your neighborhood. But when the neighbors and the communities asked the CHP officers, why am I not being let back in my home? Is the fire not contained? What are the reasons? Nobody had answers for them. And, you know, when you have to walk 3 miles to get internet, to get any kind of information out of your neighborhood, plus why don't you have a car to escape the neighborhoods that are apparently at risk of going in a wildfire? There's a serious lack of communication during these kind of events. And I can somewhat understand with limited resources, all the resources are focused on fighting the fires. And I applaud them in those efforts, but I think there definitely needs to be a higher communication system. And I know in talking with Henry Senator Stern's office this last Sunday, an event we did with him, he's kind of taking this up as a banner issue of just increasing the amount of communications during these disasters.
Now, we're nearing the end of our time, so we're going to have to hit this quickly. But the recent fires became just one more point of conflict between the Donald Trump administration and California. So remind us, Kerry Kavanaugh, where things stand on the topic of fire between Trump, California Governor Brown, and California.
I believe there was a hint of kumbaya when the president came to California and met with Governor Brown and Governor-elect Gavin Newsom. But there is still a fundamental disconnect between what the federal government has been saying. The president and his Secretary of Interior have largely been focused on forest management and this idea that cutting trees and sort of aggressive forest management, aggressive thinning, is the solution to California's fires.
Which meets with their agenda of industrial development and promoting logging.
Correct. And it was a total head-scratcher when he's saying this while Malibu is burning. And it's like, where's the forest? So there is still disconnect. You know, Governor Brown has been focused on climate change and trying to reduce greenhouse gases and trying to slow the progress of global climate change. And you have a president who has been essentially denying that man-made climate change is real and refusing to take action to address that. So there's just this disconnect. They're talking past each other. And
there's also this practical issue of housing for the people displaced by the fire. There's been an issue with that as well.
With the lack of FEMA trailers and the lack of sort of housing response in Northern California, correct?
Correct, yes.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, we are not seeing the level of response that we've seen to other natural disasters across the country.
Bettina Boxall, any quick thing on that?
Well, I mean, you know, I wrote a story about this focusing on both, what Governor Brown's focus on climate change really isn't addressing anything on the ground right now. I mean, even if we stopped global warming tomorrow, I mean, it's not going to stop these fires, nor is it going to help the people who have been burned out and lost their homes. And President Trump's, comments about, I mean, they were just totally ignorant and, I mean, just totally baseless. And again, it was very much, I mean, you know, it echoed back in the early 2000s under the George W. Bush administration. That's when we had a lot of very large forest fires, real forest fires, you know, that were burning forests in Oregon and California. And there was very much a push about logging. So, I mean, this always comes up with big disasters. I mean, it came up during the drought. People use a disaster to promote their agenda, whether it is addressing climate change, whether it is logging, whether it is, you know, don't do this or do this. But Trump's comments were really completely off base, because none of the big fires that have, been so devastating in California this year, nor the wine country fires of last year, have burned in a forest. As I said, Paradise is in a forested area, but the fire tore over an area that had not only burned about a decade ago, but also had been partially logged. So the notion that forest management or thinning could have prevented any of these big fires that have swept across parts of California this past year is false.
So, Kerry Kavanaugh, as a last thought here, what are two or three policy levers we should be pushing here to make things better?
I think the suggestion that Bettina mentioned, that whatever sources gave for a coastal commission-esque state policymaking board that would oversee or have input on development decisions, I think that's very important. I think the state should be looking at opportunities to buy out, voluntary buyouts for people who don't want to rebuild or who are in communities that have burned once, twice, three times before. I think in general, the state needs to be having a much bigger conversation about how we redesign our communities in the face of climate change. And this goes beyond even wildfires. I mean, this is a larger, much larger conversation the state needs to be having.
That's all the time we have for today. You have been listening to Background Briefing with Howard Bloom sitting in for Ian Masters. We've been talking about the wildfires this time and the wildfires next time. My guests today have been LA Times reporter Bettina Boxall, LA Times editorial writer Kerry Cavanaugh, and Ezekiel Chalais, who is the executive director of the Mountains Restoration Trust. And again, if you are local listeners, the Mountains Restoration Trust is having upcoming events at 6 p.m. tonight, Thursday, in the Agoura Hills Calabasas Community Center. Experts will walk you through the fascinating complexities of fire ecology. And a week later, that town hall presentation is going to take place in Malibu. So for more information, go to the events page on the website of the Mountains Restoration Trust. In fact, they have a lot of interesting events coming up. I want to thank Mike Heflin for recording us today and also producer Graham Fitzgibbon. And by the way, you can listen to my regular show, Deadline LA, on Mondays at 6:30 p.m. Pacific Time at kpfk.org and on the old-fashioned radio waves at 90.7 FM Los Angeles and the local Pacifica Network. You can find this installment of Background Briefing online at backgroundbriefing.org, or you can subscribe wherever you get your podcast. Please rate and review this show on iTunes, Google Play, SoundCloud, and you can share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. We're off the air tomorrow, but Ian will be back on Sunday, back from his vacation. So for now, thanks to all of you for listening.